Backseat Producers, episode 295, The Conversation.
Movie with Jack Nicholson that was pretty all right. I liked it, but and Twister, she was in Twister.
Yeah, but you know what? They picked
this fun movie.
I love Twister.
Crichton movies. They have. I don't know if he's got some weird contractual thing about women that look like Helen Hunt.
You mean like how Lily Sobieski looks exactly like Helen Hunt?
Well, yeah, like she's like her little sister or daughter or clone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that.
Maybe there's one we could do. Twister.
Yeah. Yes, talk about Twister.
Wow, that would be.
It's so fantastic, and I find myself watching it without fail. I will somehow watch it like once every.
It's
year
not a bad
two.
Movie, actually. It's pretty good.
It's great. I mean,
it didn't get the traction that it really should have gotten because it's actually.
There's a ride at Universal Theme Parks.
Yeah, called Twister. Yeah,
the Twister attraction.
Oh man! Well, something about how, you know, being Midwestern and you think like, oh, you know, a Twister is going to kill me at any moment. So I'll watch this terrible science movie about tornadoes. I love that movie. I love bad science movies, like The Core. Great movie.
I don't think I've seen The Core.
Mm. Oh, you got to experience it at least once.
Oh,
it is,
my God.
Yes, with the material they used to build the ships out of. Unobtainium.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
they made no pretense to say.
No, that was from Avatar.
Yep.
Unless they used it for that also.
I think they did, yeah.
Wow.
Well, my sister told me this story about she was in college, and she was a geology major, and she went to Northwestern, and so she and a bunch of her geology friends went to go see The Core, I think, and just wanted to hack it to pieces because it's the core. It's the most ridiculous movie. It's so stupid, and the science is so bad, but... I don't know. Something about watching bad science makes me feel better as a person because I feel like if I can recognize bad science, then, you know, maybe I'm not that dumb after all.
You're smarter than the average Hollywood producer.
Apparently.
All right, let's go ahead and get started because that actually leads kind of into a topic. Hey, this is Tony.
And this is Daryl.
And this is Jolie.
And we're the Backseat Producers. And we're talking tonight about, I forgot.
The conversation. Let's have this conversation.
It's been a rough week.
Sounds like it.
So we've actually had comments on the website.
Ooh.
What?
Something we haven't had for a while.
They've been creeping in more lately.
Wow. We're gaining an audience again. Exciting. We're rebuilding it.
Yeah, so... last week we talked about gravity,
mm-hmm.
and we had some really nice comments from David J. and Danny. David J., he said, of course the dead kid had a place in the movie.
Damn straight the dead kid did.
Mm-hmm. He makes better arguments than we made about this. I didn't make arguments for the dead kid, so made better arguments than you guys made.
Mm-hmm.
Gravity kept coming back to birth imagery and religious imagery. Everyone agreed that there had to be something there to put Sandra Bullock in her shell or womb, if you want to get gross about it, so that she could eventually emerge all wet and glistening.
Oh, God.
To fit one of the themes, it had to either be something to do with the child or something to do with religion, and the religion angle would have been even more cliche than the dead kid. Also, I don't think Clooney would have won the spacewalk record no matter how much oxygen he had left. He'd only last about as long as it took for that shrapnel cloud to cycle around again. And now I'm going to go cry. Danny, who is a genius, said, I side with Tony on gravity.
I thought it was completely a biased opinion.
I thought it was okay, but I didn't love it, and I really don't understand why it's getting so much love with critics. Tony, you made an observation that I would like to address, and I'm going to leave that part in about what your sister was saying about the core, because it kind of goes into what he's got here.
Right.
You made an observation I'd like to address. You spoke about subject matter experts, lawyers, doctors, cops, etc., watching a film about their specific profession and then nitpicking the technical flaws. You are, of course, right on the money, but I would also like to address that when subject matter experts watch a film about their specific profession and the movie gets it right, when the movie professionals act using correct procedure and correct protocol, it becomes a happy bonus and falls into the lexicon of a specific occupational group's favorite movies. I speak from experience on this. In 2010, I was deployed with Navy EOD guys, and one night we watched The Hurt Locker. I couldn't tell you a thing about the movie except the fact that the EOD guys nitpicked absolutely everything the actors did. They said, no, you don't go split up to cover more ground. No, you don't defuse an explosive like that, to name a few examples. I've admittedly not watched the movie since and have no interest in seeing it again, specifically because my first experience with it was, if not spoiled, very skewed. On the flip side of that coin, we watched Men of Honor almost every night, watching Cuba Gooding Jr. rise to the challenge of becoming the first African-American Navy diver, surprisingly accurate regarding both the military aspect and the Navy diver technical aspect, and the fact that the writers and directors took the time to do their research and get their facts straight regarding the technical specifics and operational hazards of diving made for a truly enjoyable movie experience. It also doesn't hurt that Cuba Gooding Jr. is a phenomenal actor. I myself, after spending 10 years in the Navy, have a soft spot for many military movies that portray the military and infantry correctly and plausibly. Admittedly, they are mostly World War II and Vietnam films, though I do have a soft spot for Down Periscope and Crimson Tide. Just like I roll my eyes at movies who do it poorly. Battleship.
Battleship was a fantastic movie.
Just turn off your brain and watch it. It's fun, yes.
I just wanted to mention the flip side of being a subject matter expert, watching a film about your profession and being very pleased when it's done right. Keep up the great work. So thanks, guys, for the comments. So I don't know that we're really going to have anything to talk about in this. Though I do feel like a connection to Hackman being, you know, messing with audio and stuff. Mm-hmm. Nowhere near to the technical ability that character had. But we play with the audio a little bit from time to time.
Yeah, but
a couple weeks ago, I actually had to fix a really bad recording we had. It was there was a buzz that went all the way through it. It was unlistenable the first time through, and I had to tweak it a few times. Yeah. But it's interesting. Yeah. That was one of the things that we'll talk about here in a few minutes. So next week, Manhattan. Is that what we talked about?
Fantastic. Fantastic.
One of his better movies.
If I'm not mistaken, this is the first Woody Allen movie that we've talked about.
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken. Yes. Like ever.
How
almost
do
300
you...
episodes.
Wow. How do you get away with that?
Because
there's so many other movies around it. And there's only so many available on streaming.
Yeah, but he's made so many good movies.
And we just gotta get to one.
I've seen bits and pieces of a couple of his movies and thought they were terrible. Admittedly, I was in my teens and it was like, yeah, this looks dumb, and moved on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna say he's for everyone, but if you kind of filter it and get past and say, okay, well, this is very clearly a Woody Allen movie. He makes movies a certain way, and sometimes they're just fantastically witty, and sometimes they're, you know.
They just fall flat.
Yeah, oftentimes they do, but when they're good, like when I said Crimes and Misdemeanors, one of my favorite movies ever, that movie is so good, and it's not a comedy. It's not really funny, but so good.
All right.
On to the conversation.
Let's talk about the conversation.
Yeah.
Let's have a conversation.
Jillie, what did you think?
I thought it was really, really good. It's not like it's kind of not what I was expecting just because it was so quiet. And I guess, I mean, I was pleasantly surprised by it, but I thought it was really good. And there's a lot of parts about it that I really, really enjoyed, and especially in kind of a historical context. So that was my overall summary. I really liked it.
I'll say pretty much the same thing. I was really surprised with this movie. Of Coppola movies I've seen, this one really kind of took me back a little bit. And we'll get into some details on that, but I enjoyed a lot of the little details he threw in there. A lot of the cinematography is pretty damn interesting.
I'm looking back at his writing and directing credits. He goes back quite a way. Mm-hmm. This one came out after The Godfather, between Godfather and Godfather Part II.
It's also a completely different film from those. I mean, it's really interesting. You could change gears that fast.
Yes. Yeah. I was just looking also at some of his screenwriting credits, just because I was curious about his screenwriting credits before and about this time. He had Patton, The Godfather, The Way We Were. He was an additional writer on that, uncredited. He wrote the screenplay for The Great Gatsby, Conversation, Godfather Part Two.
Is that the with Robert Redford, The Great Gatsby?
I was wondering about that. Looking now. Yes, it is the Redford. Redford and Mia Farrow.
Right.
Now with a little technical detail here. Screenwriting is a very specialized writing business. And it is completely different from knocking out, say, a novel. Because in a novel, the writer can flow all the scenery and everything else. Where a screenwriter has to sit there and say, okay, here's the dialogue. This is what the camera is going to be placed at. This is what I want to look. This is what's going to happen. So on and so on. So he's got the dialogue running on one side of the page, and he's got all the cinematographer's instructions on the other side of the page.
Right.
It's very, very specialized, and not everybody can do it really well.
They credited him with doing The Godfather, a novel for television. They must have miniseriesed The Godfather at some point. Apocalypse Now, Rumblefish, mm-hmm. which we actually talked about, Rumblefish.
Very strange movie there.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so I was introduced to this movie through this story of film thing that I've been mm-hmm. watching and been talking about.
On TCM.
Yeah, and this is one of the movies that they mention mm-hmm. in the course of it. So I was, I've been kind of paying attention to the movies that they're listing there and trying to watch some of them. So this one kind of jumped up on the radar because of that. And I was like, well, this is a good excuse to talk about it. And I enjoyed it.
Yeah. And the really thing is this movie has aged well. I mean, the topics they're talking about the topic that they cover in this movie still holds terrible amount of reverence to this day.
So when I get about halfway through the movie and, spoiler mm-hmm. for anybody who's not seen the movie. There's a nice twist at the end.
Oh yeah.
There's a really nice twist at the end that they're leading you in one direction.
Yeah, the red herrings in this movie are just delicious.
They twist it pretty well, and it's beautiful the way they do. Everything is on screen in the first 5 minutes of the movie. You see everything.
Yeah.
You don't hear it, but you see it. You see everything, but you don't hear it, and that's pretty brilliant. But I got about halfway through the movie and thought, this is kind of a spiritual remake of Rear Window.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, I mean, it's not the same.
Right, because in Rear Window, he witnesses it. In this one, he hears it.
Right. But there's kind of a correlation there that in Rear Window, he's in a wheelchair, he can't move, mm-hmm. he can't get out of the apartment, he's locked in. In this, his paranoia and
locks him in.
It locks him in. It keeps him paralyzed. It keeps him from getting out and experiencing the world in the way that he kind of wants to, but he absolutely cannot.
Well, this is, I think, is also a kind of a critique of the total expert, a man who is so competent in his field that he's totally blind to everything around him.
Yeah.
I mean, this is kind of like a proto hacker. I mean, they're so competent at this one thing. You take them out of that little field, and they just fall apart.
Yes.
And this guy is Well, we find out later this emotional crippling that he's experienced was due to another trauma from a job he did.
Right.
And it's kind of interesting. We keep finding out these little teeny tiny details and keep getting teased out of him because he's more of the mystery in front of the camera than the one that's happening off camera.
I spent the whole time drawing parallels to Walter White, and I couldn't not do that because there every time he would do something, I would be like, oh, that's just like Walter White would do.
I think the difference there is that Walter White was, for anybody who doesn't know who we're talking about, from Breaking Bad. I can't imagine.
Who are you?
I can't imagine if you've listened to this podcast, you haven't heard us gush about Breaking Bad.
Well, that's for future generations. Yeah. They may not have witnessed it. So.
Yeah. When people are going back and listening to episode 295.
Yes, in 2050, they're going to have this. What was this Walter White guy? It was a reference to a rather popular television drama back in the early part of the 21st century.
Very quaint.
So all you future archivists, there's your reference point.
Yeah, so I think the difference, though, is that Walter White, he made his shell around him. It was something he very deliberately did. His paranoia was something that he built from within. And I kind of get the feeling that Harry Call, the character from this movie, it was his blindness to it is what really kind of it caught up with him and burned him.
Yeah, I sort of looked at it as kind of like he had, he had kind of like crippling, I don't want to say social anxiety, but maybe something like social anxiety, such that you kind of knew that he was this guy who does things, but he doesn't do people very well. So he doesn't know how to deal with people.
Yeah, being in IT, I don't know anyone like that.
Yeah.
Well, this is interesting.
People stare at shoes a lot. Yeah,
it's kind of interesting, though. This is a guy who's bad with people, but what does he do? He spends all his time looking into their lives.
Yeah.
Or spying into their lives.
Right. So he does not have a skill set that allows him to deal with really stressful situations.
Well, that's kind of a hazard of that business, though, is you don't want to get too emotionally involved. And he starts when he hears this conversation, he makes every mistake that has probably kept him insulated.
Well, and you also kind of get the sense of how everyone else reacts to mm-hmm. when he tells them what he does and what they know about him. Like when he meets all of his colleagues at the convention, they're all talking shop and talking about the stories of the people. Mm-hmm. And he's more interested in the technical aspects. Mm-hmm. And when he does finally brag, it's the technical mm-hmm. aspects that he's bragging about. It's not the conversation. It's not who the people are. It's
or
not
what it was about or what anything they're talking else. About. Yeah.
Even though that's what everybody wants to know.
Oh, look at me.
About.
I have a clever hack.
Right, right. It has nothing to do with the information you found out. Mm-hmm. It has everything to do with how you got it.
Yes. And, that's just it. That's all they came to pester him on is, how did you do that? I mean, how did you get the microphone onto the boat? How did you do this, edit together this whole conversation over this huge area?
Right.
I mean, and some of the ideas are, you know, they seem to be, like, if you think about them for a second, are pretty obvious. But, you know, sometimes you get so focused on your problem, you miss the obvious.
It's, you know, in thinking about, you know, how this movie translates still today, mm-hmm. I think when you called out the proto-hacker mm-hmm. idea, you could almost do a remake of this movie with a conversation between mm-hmm. people online thinking they're encrypted, mm-hmm. changing encryption codes and things like that, and you have somebody that's piecing together and getting bits and pieces of the
right.
conversation.
He could be an FBI or NSA or some other white hat hacker. He's just doing penetration testing and comes across these conversations.
Well, sure. I sort of feel like this movie has been remade in sort of different, because there was a movie that came out several years ago, won an Oscar for Best Foreign Film called The Lives of Others. I don't know if you've seen it. Mm-hmm. Kind of a similar story in that it's about a guy who taps phones for the East German Stasi, and so he comes across you know, he starts listening into mm-hmm. these people. And so, you
living
know,
his life by through them.
Right, exactly. And then the other movie that I kept thinking it was kind of like was 1 Hour Photo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in that, I sort of saw a similar parallel of like, this is obsession with a specific subject matter, because there wasn't, well, I know, I mean, there's obviously a reason why he would become obsessed with these particular people, like, because of the threat of imminent danger, but.
Well, yeah, he's reliving, he's thinking, well, hold on, this is something that from that previous incident where the family got killed because of his job.
Right. But the obsession,
right.
But the obsession of why this one over all others.
Mm-hmm. Well, know? Yeah, what set this one off?
Right. Which to me, I'm thinking like, well, it's because he's maladjusted, or, I mean, you know.
Well, that's something we really don't really understand through the movie, why this particular bunch or this particular man and woman draws his attention. I mean, he's no doubt recorded hundreds of other types of these conversations. Maybe just.
I think part of it was, and I think they kind of allude to it. It's why mm-hmm. why were they being so secretive?
Yes,
they were very deliberately. They very much believed that they were being listened to. So they were doing
right.
They were doing all the things you should do if you're trying to avoid
someone overhearing a conversation.
They went over by the musicians and talked in low voices so that mm-hmm. they couldn't be heard. They covered themselves so that even like his cohorts, when mm-hmm. when he tries to get them to guess how he did it, mm-hmm. They were saying, you know, hire lip readers and things like that. And
yeah, they were doing solutions.
They were moving and doing things in certain ways so that they kept changing directions. And a stationary lip reader wouldn't mm-hmm. have been able to catch the whole conversation, at least not one. You'd have to have a couple of them. So I think it was. I think that piqued his interest. Why are they hiding? What are they hiding?
Yeah.
Because they're very deliberately hiding themselves. And if they're deliberately hiding themselves, there's a reason. There has to be a reason that they're deliberately hiding themselves. And then why is this so important to the person that's hiring me?
Right.
Which it's probably fairly obvious most of the time when he gets hired. You know, what's
well, they also paying him huge bucks too.
Right. Yeah.
Enough so that he can afford all the sophisticated equipment and the extra personnel he had to bring in to do this.
Yes.
I mean, his solution was, you know, just blanket the whole area with microphones and just capture every little bit and re-edit it all back together. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, he's only, when he's doing his little editing and filtering thing, he's only using 3 tape recorders. I guess that's the limit of the technology of 74, but pretty phenomenal that he's sitting there manually listening to every little fragment and editing it all back
together. I think that there's a little bit of technical fidgeting going on.
Yeah, I know.
Because there would have probably been more recordings. And, you know, the first thing you learn as a podcaster, if you're editing, is you do not edit from your speakers.
Mm-hmm.
You edit with headphones on. You have some good quality headphones covering
the studio monitors there.
Covering your ears so you get
the audience would never hear it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So they were doing a little bit of technical fidgeting just so that you could tell a good story.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those things that I'm watching it the whole time going, you should be wearing headphones. You should be wearing headphones. You would hear everything if you were wearing the headphones.
Well, maybe he didn't want to hear everything. Well, he would filter out all the background noise.
Yeah. So that was more just amusing.
That would be probably something a surveillance guy would probably nitpick a little bit.
Yeah.
Studio is probably where he's located and doing this is probably the absolute worst location. I mean, in a warehouse, all the hard walls. Echoes would have been just terribly distorting.
Big open room with hard walls, no soundproofing anywhere.
But it was a cool location.
It was cool and gadgety mm-hmm. and like.
Also, imagine what that place goes for now.
Oh, God.
In San Francisco.
Well, jeez. in that time period, those things were probably a dime a dozen.
Well, right, but
and, you know, an unused floor in a warehouse. But it does give Kevin an interesting ambience because he's got this huge open space and he's located in this one little teeny
one
tiny
little corner. Of it, yeah.
And the guy, big enough, there's enough space that the guy can ride his scooter around in it and pop wheelies.
So
proto-hackerspace.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the actors in this movie. So you had Gene Hackman, who I thought did a fantastic job.
Yes.
As always.
And, he's playing against his own type, too.
He's so good. And, yeah, he was great. John Cazale, I think that's how you pronounce his name. Is Stan.
I think it's Cazale.
Cazale?
Yeah.
Probably. Cazale actually makes more sense considering. He was Stan, his partner.
Mm-hmm.
He was great. We talked a little bit last week about how that guy's been in this golden handful of movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this was the one movie of his that I hadn't seen, if I'm not mistaken. Let's see.
Yeah, it was Godfather Part II, this one, Deer Hunter, and Dog Day Afternoon, yeah.
And he was in a short called The American Way and was in one episode of a TV series called NYPD in 68. He was credited.
I've never seen that series.
Interesting. He's The American Way, the short. He was a production assistant and editor on that. And he was cinematographer for a short called The Box. Anyway, yeah, he's a great. He's been in some really great movies.
Mm-hmm.
And for anybody who knows of The Godfather but don't know exactly who we're talking about, it's Fredo.
Mm-hmm.
He's like the Kurt Cobain of 70s cinema. That's right, I said it.
You mean maybe really not all that talented, but man, he was in things that people really latch onto and remember. Yeah, I said that.
Yeah.
let's see, what else? Well, there was Cindy Williams.
Yeah.
Shirley, of Laverne and Shirley.
Terry Garr.
Terry Garr, yeah, that was...
I did not recognize her with that hair, and then I was like, oh man, she, yeah.
And man, was young Han Solo not a dick?
Oh my God. Harrison Ford,
man.
He's about the second movie he was in.
I heard an interview with him today where he said that after he did this movie, he wasn't getting any other parts, so he went back to carpentry after he did this movie, which I thought was just
strange. I mean, the movie before he did this was American Graffiti, which is the one that he's most remembered for. Then he's in this one,
and the next movie was Star Wars. He did some TV stuff. I'm looking at his thing now. He did a few TV shows. He was in an episode of Kung Fu.
Mm-hmm. Oh man.
He was in a couple of episodes of Gunsmoke as different people. Gunsmoke was like the Law and Order of the 70s.
The 60s
and 70s. Well, this was 72 and 73 when he did those.
Mm-hmm. Well, those were Gunsmoke's waning days. So.
Yeah. Ironside, the Virginian, Love American Style.
That was the real surprise there. Hold on. I remember watching that every Friday night. And surprisingly, Love American Style launched the careers of a hell of a load of people.
That and Love Boat and Fantasy Island, those were more dredging people back up to show them in things than launching careers.
Yeah, but Love American Style was pretty much launched a lot of careers. It was a pretty lighthearted little series.
I remember my mom watching it in reruns,
mm-hmm.
like afternoon, you know, when watching her stories kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that character that he played, though, mm-hmm. that guy was a dick.
Yeah.
Appropriately, that was his job, but I thought that was kind of fun. And I was just surprised when Robert Duvall shows up, because
mm-hmm.
he's uncredited. Like, he is not credited at all, and he's just there. It's like, whoa.
Yeah.
And so is Billy Dee Williams. Billy Dee Williams is in the movie.
Where was he?
He was the man in the yellow hat.
I'm thinking.
Oh, it's the beginning. It's the beginning of the movie when he's walking, the mime is walking around annoying everybody.
Oh.
Billy Dee Williams and two of their friends are walking by up the on the Union Union Park Plaza there.
Sure, I remember.
So the confessional priest slash security guard was Richard Hackman, who is Gene Hackman's brother.
Nice.
Giancarlo Coppola was the boy in the church.
Oh yeah,
Coppola and nepotism pretty well go hand in hand, though.
Come on, it was a small part.
That guy loves putting family in things, which is, I think, is cool.
Saves on the budget.
And then Frederick Forrest, who I had to look up the guy's name, but he was the guy that was walking around and with Cindy Williams, mm-hmm. Who I recognize his face from things, but I don't know his name clearly. Now I'm looking up to see what other things that I remember him from. He was the captain on 21 Jump Street. He was in Valley Girl, The Rose, Apocalypse Now.
So he's essentially he's a character.
Yeah,
guy.
He's a character guy.
Yeah. So I did not recognize
him. I recognize him from being in other things, and it's nothing in particular. Black Thunder.
Yeah, what is that?
I don't know. He was in an episode of Murphy Brown. So yeah, I thought the acting was solid all the way around.
Yeah, I had a hard time with just how handsome young Han Solo is. Just Harrison Ford, he's hard to look at just because it's like, oh man, he's too good looking. Can't handle it.
He only has about 3 or 4 faces, though.
That's all you need.
And he That's made all he made need. All of it. It's like, I recognize that Han Solo face. I recognize that Indiana Jones face.
Yes, exactly.
I recognize that Rick Deckard face.
When it works, it works. Just like I mentioned.
There must be something going because it's lasted 30 years.
Well, just like I mentioned, I saw the new Thor movie last night, and Chris Hemsworth is hard to look. He's just too good looking. He's hard to look at. You kind of have to like put your thumb up and not look at his face.
See, I don't understand like, that.
Well, you got to remember, he is a god.
I know. I know. But the thing
he's
is,
he's supposed to be perfect.
So I know. But the thing is you look at him and he's like, he has two.
He sparkles.
He has two expressions. Well, you probably. He has two expressions. He has that kind of smirky thing that he does, and then he has like the 1,000-yard stare. And that's pretty much it. But the thing is you don't need more than that. That's... You can have those two expressions and totally carry an entire movie because there's no need to put any more.
Come on. We're talking about a Marvel movie, a comic book movie. We're not talking about high art here. We're talking Saturday afternoon popcorn entertainment.
Right, right. Well, but, you know, if you want to talk about is Harrison Ford a good actor? Well, yeah, he's great, even if he's just like...
He has a limited expression. He has a limited emotional range.
And that's...
But what he does is really good.
But looking at him in this movie, it's like, this is really close to when he played Han the first time. It's within 3 years of when he played Han Solo. So it's like... Man, it is right about that same age, and you don't get a whole lot closer to how he looked in that. Maybe like Force 10 from Navarone. That was another one where he was like right at that age. Mm-hmm. That one was just a year later.
And one that he probably regrets doing.
Apocalypse Now.
Unfortunately, his part in it was cut out.
Yeah.
Up on the editing room floor, which is too bad.
But yeah, I saw his name in the credits and didn't. I was surprised. I wasn't expecting to see him. But considering how Lucas and Spielberg and Coppola were all kind of buddies.
We know two of them were,
incestuous relationship.
Yeah.
They all talked a lot of cross-pollination between them, yeah.
Yeah. So given that, and then hearing the he was just a carpenter when he got the Han Solo job, it's like... Mm-hmm. Really? He was also in American Graffiti, and he was in this. And it's like, what he was doing. But somebody knew, hey, you might want to give that guy a call.
Maybe. I mean, I'm just going off of what he said, which I think is just an adorable detail. Just hearing that, you know, if he was working carpentry just because that's what he wanted to do between acting gigs, that's adorable.
Well, that's
acting. He was doing carpentry in Hollywood.
Yeah, that's well known that he was doing. He was a carpenter in Hollywood when he got the Han Solo job. That's mm-hmm. that's been known for a billion years. Mm-hmm. But considering he didn't get work after this, and to be fair, it was 3 years between this and A New Hope.
Well,
but there was there's also TV shows and movies.
Well, Begging the Thing was there was 3 years between the time this movie came out and Star Wars came out. In between they were making the movie.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I like the movie. I liked how broken he was.
Oh yeah.
Like from you get it from the beginning straight off. How did you know that it was my birthday? How did you get into the house? How did you get into my apartment? When his apartment has an alarm on it.
Yeah.
You know, he's so paranoid that he lives by himself. He's the only one that has the key. His place has an alarm, but he doesn't have anything in his place.
Mm-hmm. Except his sex.
And he's got two phones. Mm-hmm. One that he calls out on and one that he gets calls in on.
I don't have a phone.
Right.
But yeah, he uses pay phones all over the place.
Right.
Yeah.
Super paranoid. But he understands how, in his mind, how easy it is to bug someone, to get information on someone, to hack them. And then the brilliant move is that he is the technical hacker, but he gets socially engineered.
Engineered all the time.
Yeah, he gets socially engineered.
Which is the most common hacking.
Yeah, and it was when that woman showed up and starts dancing with him and flirting with him, I'm like, he's getting played.
Yes,
he is getting played.
Well, also, and the one little simple thing when he's at the convention, his colleague reaches over and, you know, here's a pen.
Yeah.
You don't think about that until, hold it, he just bugged me.
Yeah.
And I should have known that. I'm in a convention full of surveillance experts, and somebody hands me a gift, and you don't expect it to be rigged?
It's brilliant because he's so technically proficient that he doesn't need to stoop to social engineering.
That's one of the things too, is he's going to the convention, he's sniffing up his nose at all the other vendors saying, oh, that's junk. I make my own stuff. You're junk. Right. Well, they're junk. Just played you.
Just nailed him, yeah.
Just played you.
Because they use the technique that works best against people,
mm-hmm.
which is
you socially engineer.
Yeah, glad handle him. You get him when their guard is down.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he drops his guard. When he keeps his guard up, he's pretty well protected. But the moment he drops it, he's boom.
And he drops it. The way that scene plays out when it's after the convention and they bring the girls back to his place.
The after party.
They're drinking. They're having a good time. They're goading him to tell him the story. And then he just, like, he gets this smile on his face. Yeah. He's like, so here's how it happened. And he's just like, he's just in his moment. He's just so thrilled to be lording over them. It's like, so how cool am I?
Well, they keep telling him, oh, you're the genius that we've all heard about. They're sitting there, stroking his ego all up and pumping him.
And because they know that works.
It totally works.
Yes.
And he opens himself up, and he just keeps opening himself up, and then they, boom, nail him. Mm-hmm. And he just slams shut again mm-hmm. in, like, the worst way. That scene was put together in a beautiful way. Just the way they teased him and just dug into his head.
The final insult in that whole scene is when he wakes up the next morning and the tape's gone.
The tape's gone, yeah.
And he said, oh, God, I have been totally played. Yeah. That's when he finally realizes that not only was I played by that, I was played by her, too.
Yeah.
She really mind warped me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, one thing I didn't understand in this movie was the first woman he met. He goes to her apartment. Is that his ex-wife, girlfriend, a prostitute, or what? Because
it's just a girl. I think it's a friend.
He cares about.
Yeah, that she wants to be more serious, but he's of course keeping her at arm's length just because he can't let it.
Can actually connect because one thing she says at the end when he's walking to the door, he says, "I won't wait for you forever."
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I'm like, okay,
I won't
how
wait
long
for you anymore?
Yeah, I keep getting the idea. Okay. what sort of relationship was going on here? It seems to be very cold. Like he wants to make an emotional connection, and they know each other fairly well.
Yeah.
Apparently, there's been some long running relationship there because he just let himself into her apartment.
Right.
But, yeah, I think it's it seems to be that it's purely sexual.
Mm-hmm.
There really isn't a relationship.
There's no emotional connection.
I wouldn't say that. I think he has an emotional connection, but I think he's afraid to express it.
Yeah.
Because
he's still a locked door.
He doesn't want to get burned. He doesn't want to be played. He does because the weakness in the chain of privacy is when you let someone else in.
Mm-hmm.
You can control what you do, but if you let somebody else in, that opens up the door to
an attack vector. Yeah.
Yeah.
She was very obviously connected to him because she was letting him do things that are just like coming over while she's sleeping because she was asleep when he showed up and mm-hmm. he let himself in and she's like,
as I say, there's some intimacy there. They've known each other long enough that they trust each other very well.
Right, but that's the kind of shit that, you generally don't put up with unless it's somebody that you really care
about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
paying the rent too.
I think for her it was she thought that she'd be able to crack this guy. Mm-hmm. That he was devoted to her because of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And because all the goofy stereotypes of, oh, he's just playing hard to get, which just draws her in even more. And
she's going to fix him.
She's going to fix
him. Yeah, she's going to fix him. She's going to, she'll wait for him because the payoff's going to be there because, man, if he's got these secrets, it must be important. And, there's got to be a really good reason for it.
Because she doesn't even know what he does. She's good at one point. She right. Asks, what do you do? She doesn't even know.
Yeah, and I think we get a little more insight to that in that conversation he has with the girl that eventually ends up stealing the tapes when they're dancing, and he says, "Look, here's the way it is. Can you love someone who will not tell you anything? Who will be secretive? Who will be private? Who will not open himself up? Who you're never going to know these things about me." Or about him. He's always saying in the third person. He never says himself. He never puts himself in that position. But it's very much, can you deal with this?
Mm-hmm.
Can you put up with this?
Can you live?
Because this is the
can
way.
Can you accept it? Can
this
you
is my live, life.
Yeah, this. Can you accept me for what I am, knowing that you will probably never know everything?
Yeah.
Or even a little bit of anything?
Yeah.
And no doubt that's probably for his, not for her, their safety as much as his.
And I think that kind of retroactively explains the relationship he had with Terry Garr.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's exactly what we saw. He just explains it a little more. He puts a little more
opens
detail
it up.
To it.
Well, the thing is, he's opening up to her. He's opening up to
right.
a stranger, or at least he's a partially intoxicated one. But his guard comes down.
And presumably he's had this conversation. I mean, you kind of get the sense that he's had this conversation with Terry Garr, at least in bits and pieces, that she knows that he's like this. It's not a surprise, but she's going to keep asking. She keeps asking. She keeps needling, thinking, oh, you'll tell me now.
Eventually, you'll break down.
Yeah.
And one other thing, just change directions here, is when he finally realizes that he's been had, he starts violating every one of his own security rules.
Oh, man.
He totally forgets everything he's ever done. He starts calling out on his own phone instead of using a payphone. He's going there personally and interceding, and he's getting too emotionally involved. He tries to go into the hotel room stop the whole thing.
Just like Walter White, man. That's the whole time. Like that scene at the end where he lays waste to his own apartment. And I kept coming back to that scene in Breaking Bad where he's like, where he's looking for the fly. And then he says it's all contaminated because that's essentially what mm-hmm. he was doing. He's tearing up at his apartment because,
Well, that's just it. Here's a guy who's supposed to be a security expert. And what's he do? He just, instead of going at it in a more methodical way, he just tears the whole place apart looking for it.
Yeah.
He just like,
well, because his... He very much lives in a house of cards,
mm-hmm.
and his house of cards is secure
and tight and focused, and it's
now been penetrated.
It's been knocked down before, and then he's just built it up better, and he's built a better force field around it, and it starts to crack. It starts to crack from the beginning. The first thing we see is him having his birthday and walking into his apartment, and his
more incensed about it than anything else.
He has been violated, and it's that he goes back. I think that's what he goes back to at the very end of the movie when he's tearing that place apart. It's like this will not stand. I can't be here.
Aggression will not stand.
It's great. It's so great that he just completely loses it and he tears himself apart. And I think the beauty of it too is there's some really great symbolism in what's going on there, because he starts looking for the things that are most sacred to him and tearing those things apart, because they make a point when his buddy says, "Oh, Jesus Christ," and he's like, "No, don't you take his name in vain."
Yeah.
It's like, that is something that I believe in and that I hold sacred. There's a point when he's tearing apart his apartment, he turns and looks and sees
the figurine, was it Mary?
Which makes sense for Coppola that it would be a Catholic imagery. So he takes Mary and he just shreds it, just tears it apart, looking for the bug, thinking they're going to hit me, because that's what I would do. Yeah. I would hide it in the place that they would be least likely to destroy. It'd be least likely,
and
the would be most sacred to them.
And the one place that he does, they put the bug and finally figured out in the end, was the one thing he didn't tear apart.
The saxophone.
The saxophone.
Yeah.
Think about it for a second. That's his only other hobby he's got, is playing the sax, and it's the most sacred thing to him, more than his religious icons there or anything else. Where else are you going to put it?
It's the thing that he also doesn't really share.
Yes. And what did they play back to him when they had him on the phone? His sax playing.
Mm-hmm.
And you notice they don't carry the music that he was playing to. It's just the sax.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's only one place that could be then.
And what's he do at the very end of the movie? He's sitting there in his wreckage playing his sax. Without the musical accompaniment. And he's playing the sax really well.
Yeah.
Because he struggles when he tries to play in time with the music.
Yeah, so, like, watching, and this is one of the things that I wish Adam was here for, because watching this movie and seeing him play the sax, I was thinking he could be part of our band.
You can be a sax player, yes.
Yeah.
Also sax.
Oh, that's, I don't know, that's getting into, like, Bruce Springsteen territory.
Well, that's fine.
Symbol of band.
Hey, we're...
All...
You know what? Apparently saxophones are coming back in rock music, so...
Hey, about time.
What do I know?
Well, this is it. Hopefully rock is getting away from all the technical gizmos and getting back...
No, that's not going anywhere. But...
Well, one thing I wish they'd kill off is the auto-tuner, because if I hear one more auto-tuned voice or instrument... I've pretty much given up with music of the 21st century.
I like auto-tuned voices when it's clearly done for the goof. When it's so over the top that it's like, yes, we're doing this to get this effect. Not because this person can't sing, but because it's funny.
Well, that's just it. They use it so damn much, it's become a cliche. Now, any music you hear an auto-tuner in, you're going to say, okay, that's mid-21st, it's the first decade of 21st century. It's like the polyphonic synthesizer in 80s music. It's like one of the hallmarks of 80s, is way over use of the synth.
Way overuse of reverb and all that kind of stuff, yeah.
But every decade is being kind of marked by some sort of technical gimmick that they always overuse.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, kind of bring oh man, I hate to transition this way, but since I kind of like jazz music, and I really, really, really appreciated the score in this movie. I thought it was fantastic.
That was another thing, was the sound field they put in this thing was really interesting. But also, get back on the cinematography stuff, is the use of those incredibly long shots at the beginning of the movie. It's really amazing that they sit there and just kind of slowly bring in the zoom.
Yeah.
Closer and closer from the white field down to the two people that were having the conversation.
Right, right. And that's one of the things that I mentioned as I was watching. Is like, how far away are those cameras? Like, how long are these lenses they're using? Because this is crazy.
That was awesome.
Yes. And they did it so smooth, the transition. You just, like, you're slowly moving in. You don't kind of realize that the field of view is starting to narrow down to the two people that we're looking at. So we're kind of looking at the field of view of the directional mic guy up in the tower.
Right. I wanted to see more of that mime, though.
Yeah.
I feel like this is not enough mime.
Well, first of all, the action is that mime. So you're kind of like direct your attention is drawn away by this guy. Now that was probably deliberate. Is another red herring they threw in there.
And you know what? I was kind of wondering if that. And I almost expected it to be revealed that that wasn't one of the people who was recording.
Yes, of course. Perfect. The person who doesn't speak.
Yeah, that's the person who's going to record. I thought it was clever, too, that the first thing that really draws our eye in a movie that is about sound manipulation and recording and editing is the mime. The mime is really the first thing that draws your
eye. Right. He just sits there and draws all your attention because he's the one bouncing around in the center of the view.
Yeah, yeah. There was a couple of interesting trivia things. Both Gene Hackman, as an actor, and Coppola both say that this is one of their favorite movies. Hackman, this is his favorite movie he's acted in, and Coppola says this is a perfect personal favorite of his. Hackman learned to play the sax especially for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
There was another thing. In the movie Enemy of the State, he plays a former NSA. And they use...
That's true. I've forgotten about... He was an Enemy of the State.
Better is they used images of him. They used images of a character from his younger days. They took images directly from this movie for that, which I thought
was
brilliant.
And if you remember in Enemy of the State, the Gene Hackman character is in a small workshop in a warehouse.
Yes, that's right. He's the paranoid guy. Yeah.
So, Martin Stett, who was the character that Harrison Ford played, was originally intended by Coppola to be a minor cameo, but Ford's performance convinced Coppola to make the character an integral part of the movie.
Aw, that's adorable. Yeah, he did a pretty good job with that.
The last shot of the movie, the camera pans from right to left and pulls back just like a surveillance camera would do.
Mm-hmm. And they sort of telegraph that when he's playing with the pan, tilt, and zoom camera in the convention.
Yes.
Yeah.
Extra scenes needed to complete the movie, including the one where Hackman discovers that the tape is gone, were filmed on the set of Chinatown. That's interesting. All in all, I think it's a good movie. And lots
of layers to it.
Not my favorite. I don't know that it's Gene Hackman's best acting work. I would argue that is not my favorite role of his. But, I mean, it's pretty good, but...
No, it's not. I don't think it's his best performance, but I thought it was. It's completely different type of movie.
Well, it's a very different Gene Hackman from what we had seen previously.
I think he pulls off the paranoia really well.
It's no Welcome to Mooseport. You know what I'm saying?
No, because I've never seen that.
you're missing out.
You're making things up now.
And the movie still carries a lot of weight, even in today's controversy about the surveillance of society.
Oh, yeah. This movie is just as valid
now
today
as it was then.
And it's
actually
more so. It's so much easier to capture this kind of thing. And you could easily make this movie with doing video or chats or text messaging or...
any combination of all of them.
Yeah. And in fact, it would be... more brilliant if you had a combination of taking a snippet of audio here, pieces of video there, text messages from this, you know, data communication from a cell phone here to piece together conversation on just a little bit of information and
but still the fun thing is the conversation. That the thing is, it's not about the technology, it's about the context of the conversation.
Right. Right.
And that's the huge red herring in this movie.
So let's talk about that ending for just a minute. That was awesome.
I did not see any of that coming. I thought when he flushed the toilet, that was part of the dream sequence he was having.
That
boom, it didn't hit me. No, that's it. That's the whole thing.
The fact that he was seeing and not seeing things that were there and not there was like, man, this guy is so messed up right now.
He's going into the apartment. You keep expecting to see, oh, the blood splattered all over the place. The place is torn apart. No, everything's normal. Beds are made. Everything. Bathroom sparkling clean. Okay, what did we just hear? Or what did we just witness? Was it his just paranoia just looping in? Then he flushes the toilet. Oh, it really happened.
Yeah, yeah. I thought the ending was really well done.
But it didn't hit us to who died until we see the newspaper. Oh, executive dies in car accident. Oh, it wasn't them. It was him.
Yeah, and the when he sees her,
it's
like, what? Yeah. Wait a minute,
hold on, something's wrong here.
Yeah, because she should be dead. No, I like that, and I liked the fact that they gave us everything.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't leave anything out. It was all there. They put it on the table, and it was up to your interpretation and what context you had to piece together. And we had the, you know, we were being led by the context of a paranoid man to
led by the context of our own prejudices, because, oh, man and a woman in a park acting secretive. Oh,
it's an affair.
Yeah, right. It's an affair. He's bugging her phone, trying to find out who her secret lover is. He's willing to pay all this money to find out. It's something else a little more sinister.
We have the later conversation of Robert Duvall and Harrison Ford, where Duvall's like, you know, you wanted this to be true.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, look, I've been telling you that this is going on. It's like, you just want this to be true.
Mm-hmm.
You're fabricating things to make this be true. And, like, he was still in denial about exactly what was going on.
But what is he in denial of? A denial of their affair or the fact that they're trying to murder him?
Right.
Ooh, you know, like, we keep getting led on by our own prejudices saying, oh, it's a three-way love, it's a triangle.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's way more sinister. This guy was trying to find out if he's gonna be killed.
Yeah.
We're all set up on this whole premise, and we walk in and like, oops, hey, you were led down the wrong path by by taking the conversation out of context.
Right.
You didn't hear the whole thing. You heard the bits and snippets, and you edited them all together, and then you formed your own conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Admittedly, the wrong one.
That's why you're better off just doing your job and not getting involved in context. I'm glad I saw it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everybody should probably watch it. I say you should, if you're in the technology business, you should watch this movie just for the fact is they knew about all this stuff 40 some years ago. It hasn't changed. All the techniques are still there. All the personality types are still there. In fact, they're even more amplified by today.
This is the kind of thing that I think young IT professionals who work in certain, like in the job I had before I had this one,
mm-hmm.
I worked for a nationwide, worldwide organization, and we programmed shopping cart software that we hosted. We had to go through training for Sarbanes-Oxley compliance and all that to make sure that we knew all the rules about who could be let in to the buildings and controlling all that stuff. And you know, you'd be there on a Friday night working late, and there goes one of the supervisors walking through with this woman. It's like, who is that? Oh, that's the waitress from Outback across the street. What is she doing here? Why is this happening? Why is this person in a secure building? This is not supposed to be happening. And of course, it's just, you know, some geek trying to show off the servers.
This is what
that works.
Yeah.
So well on waitresses. Oh, my God.
But you know what? You know what? It works. It worked on these.
well, a certain subset of waitresses, maybe.
So, But this is, I mean, this is the exact example of why you don't do that, because there might just be someone there who knows that your group goes to happy hour at this place because it's very close to your workplace. And hey, it's just this girl I met at happy hour, and there could be something sinister about it. It could be not who she says she is. It could be someone. I mean, in his case, it was that they were literally just trying to get what they hired him to do. But in ours, it was there could be people who are direct competitors trying to infiltrate our servers to find out what our code is, what we're doing, what are our new software releases that are coming out, or to sabotage the servers.
Yeah, so don't accept any pens or USB drives from them.
Yes. don't let them sit at your desk and check their Facebook.
Yes. That's supposedly.
Yeah.
Yes, they could be installing those key lockers. Yeah, they fit right into the keyboards nowadays.
I mean, you know, people of a certain age have all seen war games and know how you can socially engineer
everything.
A password just by that. Granted, and
people still do.
Man, that was really bad password protection. Your dead kid's name. Come on.
Well, I'll tell you what, Tony. I was doing some work in a bank one time. Oh. Big one downstairs. We had to get into the security room. They have one of those cyber locks, which has, you know, you push the little buttons.
1, 2, 3, 4.
1. It took us to do a guess. Boom. Hey, the door opened. You mean you only have one digit on the door to the security room?
Yep.
That's it?
That's it.
Not even, like, you have 6 numbers there and you only use just 1. I said, okay. I said, this is either got to be the stupidest bunch of people in the world.
I had one that our password was the 1, 2 button at the same time and the 3, 4 button at the same time. Nice. I had someone else had 1, 1, 1, 1.
They'll never get
then,
that.
Then when they had to change it, they changed it to 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. The password.
Yeah, they'll never get that.
Is a joke.
Yeah, you have the most sophisticated lock on the damn door, and what do? A 1-digit password.
Where I work now, we literally have like a 370-day password rule because we get people that complain every year that they have to change their passwords.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Granted, there are some people in my organization who only touch computer once a year. And that's for benefits, for their benefit selection. Because they dig in the dirt. Yeah.
They have very little reason to.
I work at a garden. So we have people that, like, the only time they touch a computer all year long is when they do that. Like, they don't have a computer at home. They have no need for one. That's fine. That's great. But
that's not fine.
That's fine for them, not for me.
It's your job.
I attach one to my arm and just power it on my fat. I think it never loses battery. I think that there is a lot of relevance in what this movie is talking about, both in terms of how easy it is to piece together conversations and to how exposed you are just in general, and then how easy it is to get inside the shell of someone who thinks that they're private and secretive and they can't be touched.
I think we pretty much covered this movie, so
I think so.
Wrap it up here.
All right, next week, Manhattan, Woody Allen.
Yay!
Yes.
And soon.
Woody Allen takes Manhattan, not with the Muppets.
So we have that next week. The week after that, we'll have something else. And then the week after that, it's going to be our Skanksgiving recording.
Skanksgiving recording. Yum, yum.
Which involves actual skanks? Or...
All right, so we'll explain this again the night of the recording. You're not familiar with Skanksgiving?
You have not
been a listener for more than a year then.
No.
Because we talk about this every Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. All right, so Skanksgiving is the night before Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the night that people, generally college-age people, generally single, they come back to town from being away at school. And the next day, they're going to be forced stuck. Into, yes, forced into situations with family where they're going to be, they're going to have to hang around all day with family,
eat too much food, take a nap,
watch football, take naps, parades, etc. Sure. So you have the night before where you're back in town.
Yeah.
And mom and dad are like, you go out and see your friends. You have a good time.
Yeah.
So you go out to bars and make terrible decisions.
Yeah. People do that?
Skanksgiving. Sausage Fest. Wait, Skanksgiving.
Yeah, well, hold on.
So Skanksgiving is the day before Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And since we record on Wednesdays, we always have our annual celebratory Skanksgiving recording. In years past, I've drank copious amounts of peppermint schnapps, 100-proof peppermint schnapps.
Of intoxicating liquids.
On purpose. In peppermint, in peppermint candy cane shot glasses.
Oh, my God. Such decadence.
It was fantastic. It got to the point one year that I was so drunk that I was basically just chewing on the shot glass. That's right.
They're candy, so you can't eat them.
So you just chomp, take chunks out of them.
Just remember to use the candy one, not a real one.
Yeah.
Don't get that drunk.
Well, because next day, what are you going to do? You're going to eat, so...
Yeah, really, you can sleep in late and...
You want your liver to be minty fresh. I'm hung up... I'm hung up on this idea that somebody would willingly choose to drink peppermint schnapps.
Oh, from a peppermint cup.
From a peppermint shot glass. No, it's fantastic. And it's 100-proof peppermint schnapps, too. If you're not careful, there's a tipping point there that you do not want to cross because, man, peppermint-flavored vomit...
Yeah.
It is peppermint flavored.
Yeah, I get it. It's
coming out. It covers up the bad breath.
Yeah, you don't really have that.
No, it
smells minty in here. What's going on?
I just feel like you're just vomiting up mint and regret.
No, you're vomiting up rainbows. Minty fresh ones.
And on that note, we are going to be done.
Okay, well, good night.